Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
All Australians should be deeply worried about the potential impacts of this beetle spreading.
The shot-hole borer beetle is spreading. It's already taken hold in Western Australia and now people are worried that it may go further east quicker than we expect. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire Weekly. But first, tensions at the border between Thailand and Cambodia erupted on the 28th of May after a Cambodian soldier was killed. Peace talks happened over the weekend and an unconditional ceasefire agreement was reached on Monday, but this did not hold. Carlos C. asked Dr. Dalbir Alawat from Macquarie University how this border conflict started.
If you look at the intensity of this conflict, there were artillery strikes and also the air attacks. So this is one of the biggest one in the recent history of the two countries. Around 300,000 people were displaced on both the sides. The issue is that the conflicts do not come to an end at a particular point. So what happened? That there was a mediation by the Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. Thailand was not as much agreeable because Cambodia states that it should be resolved as per the International Court of Justice that gave its decision in 1962 and again clarified in 2013. And this is in favor of Cambodia. Thailand insists that it is a bilateral issue and it should be resolved by the two countries. There was sufficient pressure from different corners, such as from the ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and also President Donald Trump of United States.
What are the global implications if this conflict continues?
In the warlike situation, people start crossing national borders in panic. As a result, that poses threat to the national security of other countries, because when other elements also take advantage of such situation, such as criminals, terrorists, also take advantage of such border crossings, and that can be certainly put a threat to the national security of other countries.
There has been quite a lot of antagonism between Cambodia and Thailand, which goes back to the Ayutthaya and Khmer kingdoms. In the grand scheme of the history of both nations, why has this conflict occurred now?
When the Franco-Siamese Treaty was signed in 1907, there, the boundaries were drawn, but these map boundaries are sort of vague. And Thailand as such now does not recognize. Cambodia insists on the French-drawn maps. Mainly the conflict is around Priha Vihar temples. This is a corridor where both the countries ascertain their claims over these temples because the faith and tourism are there. So that is becoming a critical point in the absence of clearly demarcated national boundary lines.
It seems both sides aren't well equipped to go into war at the moment, considering Cambodia is still a developing country and Thailand is also developing. What seems to be the future for this conflict?
After 5 days, it appears that Cambodia was running out of the ammunition and it approached the United Nations for a special meeting so that the ceasefire can be imposed. But both the countries have the fragile economy, and if this war goes on, then they cannot sustain it, and their trade will be affected, as will be the routine life of the people. And when these tariff issues are around, other countries like Vietnam and Indonesia can benefit from these uncertainties. So both the countries understand that this is crucial time. Economic framework need to be strengthened. Trade tariffs should be negotiated. So in a sense, if you look at the domestic constituency and the public opinion there, there is not much as much a favor for a war or an ongoing conflict. Though conflicts are difficult to resolve in one go, it takes time for building trust.
Dr. Dalbir Alawat, Senior Lecturer at the School of International Politics at Macquarie University, speaking there with Carlos Tse. The Albanese government has reversed their initial decision to exempt YouTube from the federal social media ban. Initially, YouTube was not included in the original ban. However, the inclusion of the platform comes after pressure from the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman Grant. Other major platforms that fall under the ban are Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok and X. George Popel has this story.
The federal government has reversed an earlier decision to exempt YouTube from the social media ban set to come into effect in December. YouTube have lobbied against the change and are adamant that platform is not social media, but a video sharing platform. Tama Lever is a professor of internet studies at Curtin University and a chief investigator at the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child. He argues that YouTube's claim that it is substantially different to other social media platforms is unfounded.
I don't think that YouTube is significantly differentiated from other video sharing platforms. I think TikTok and Snapchat and Instagram all share lots of video content, lots of material that can be very positive and can have educational value. And I think that's been the argument that Google has made about YouTube, that it's got high educational value. I don't dispute that, but I also think that what has been made clearer over time is that YouTube also has content that is potentially harmful. That is the same sort of content that we've been worried about being on other platforms, and that YouTube's algorithms operate in a very similar way to the algorithms of Snapchat, the algorithms of TikTok, which can potentially lead any user down a dark algorithmic path if they start searching for and spending time watching the sort of material that might be problematic.
Specifically, young people under 16 are not able to create content and make YouTube accounts. However, they are still able to watch YouTube content.
You don't have to be logged in. You don't have to be an account holder to look at YouTube content. You don't have to be an account holder to watch content that's been shared with you by a parent, shared with you by a teacher, shared with you by someone else. You also still have the capacity to search YouTube for video content, even if you're not logged in. So a lot of the affordances, a lot of the things that Google has said, oh, YouTube's really good for, it can still be good for.
It is unclear how the government are going to educate teenagers on how to handle the dangers of social media when they grow out of the ban.
What this ban achieves is essentially a 3-year delay for young people accessing these tools all the time. What we should be seeing is what happens in those 3 years. What is the way that we're going to skill up young people to be incredibly robust digital citizens, where they're going to have all of the knowledge and all of the tools available to them to navigate these spaces successfully when they do turn 16. At the moment, the only thing we've got is the ban.
Joanne Orlando is an associate professor at Western Sydney University who specialises in digital wellbeing.
So in order to stay safe online, you have to understand online. You have to understand things like algorithms, privacy, why people post the things they do online, you know, what their underlying purpose or message is, how advertising is sneakily put into things, all those kinds of things that we're kind of coming to grips with as adults. That's what children need to learn, because when a ban is done or when they're of age, they still won't have learned those things.
A common concern of the bill is that enforcing the ban will place a lot of pressure on parents.
How are parents going to enable this at home? How are they going to stop their 14-year-old who's been using YouTube and using social media? How do they then get them off in line with the ban? I think a lot of families are going to experience a lot of issues here. So what support or what education or what is the government providing for families to be able to actually enact this ban?
There is a criticism that the government should have focused on harmful features of social media platforms rather than banning these platforms entirely.
I think rather than thinking about bans of platforms, I think the government could have thought about it in a different way. You know, there are particular design features in all these platforms, and they're the ones causing the issue. So maybe if we focus on fixing up the things like, you know, never-ending content, we get that on YouTube, we get on social media, but we get it in a lot of places as well. Things like, you know, data privacy, well, that's across all kinds of apps that kids use. So those kind of features that are the problematic features, maybe that's where the efforts need to go instead.
Dr. Joanne Orlando, researcher of digital wellbeing at Western Sydney University, speaking there with George Popel. Western Australia has been set by an invasive species, the shot-hole borer beetle, and since its first appearance in 2021, state and federal governments have pledged $41 million to try and eliminate the pest. But last month, the WA government surrendered eradication efforts for management and control strategies, a move environmental experts are worried could see the beetle spread to neighbouring states. Sam Giorgio has this story.
The beetle's only found in metropolitan Perth, which is already a highly modified environment, not much natural vegetation left in the urban areas of our cities. This beetle comes from Southeast Asia and it bores into trees. It's only about 1.5 millimetres long. It lives in a symbiotic relationship with a fungus. It doesn't actually eat the wood. This fungus eats the wood and then it eats the fungus. So we can see the beetles can disperse down a city street from tree to tree kind of thing with that kind of flight power, but they're not going to travel very large distances. And we find beetles popping up 10 kilometres or more away from previous infestation sites. And so this is human movement. People can take cut wood infested with the beetle, unwittingly take it from an infested site and move it into an uninfested site. And we think that is the way the vast majority of the beetle has been spread. There's questions about how well public were informed about the beetle and informed about this type of spread.
We've seen the WA government there providing an additional $26 million in response to the pest. What do you think is the best use of that money?
The first thing I would point out is there's been almost no research done on this beetle in Australia, in Perth. The response has been following some of the methods developed overseas, especially in California. There's been very little to no research done in Perth. It depends on what you define as research. What little bit of research there has been done has been mostly done by local government authorities, you know, town councils. And this is on a very small scale because they've got very limited budgets. The one and only control method that is authorized by the government here is chop and chip. So chop and chip means the tree is chopped down and chipped into small pieces no larger than 2.5 centimetres. And then it's supposed to be heat treated through hot composting or some other similar method, because although chipping kills the vast majority of the beetles, it doesn't kill all of them.
In a media release, the Invasive Species Council warned the decision to stop eradication attempts of the shot-hole borer in Western Australia could put the rest of the country at risk, leaving Australians to prevent nationwide spread. The council's policy director, Dr. Carol Booth, echoes broader concern for the borer's potential intrusion and says despite its size, the tiny beetle could have drastic impacts on horticulture, native plant species, and Australians' agriculture industries.
You know, we've got this tiny little beetle, no bigger than a sesame seed, and it can kill giant trees. Unfortunately, it can kill trees of hundreds of different species around the world. Even in the short period of time in which it's been in Australia, in Perth, several dozen tree species have proven highly or very highly susceptible, and this includes at least 15 native Australian tree species. We extrapolate from the experience in Western Australia. I think, you know, all Australians should be deeply worried about the potential impacts of this beetle spreading, and that's impacts on horticultural trees. So, you know, they're known to cause damage to avocados and almonds and mango trees. They are known to have really quite devastating impacts on urban treescapes. Trees are so important in cities, so it could become much more expensive for local governments to be able to maintain a treescape because they'll have to cut down trees that become unsafe because they're dying from the beetle and replace those trees. But the other big impact, and it's not very well understood, is the potential for impacts on native forests. We know now that at least 15 native species are highly to very highly susceptible and others are moderately susceptible. So it suggests that there are a lot of potential trees out there that could be badly damaged.
So the WA state government, they've revealed that the eradication of the borer isn't on the cards. How do we react to this?
First of all, we have to give credit to Australia's governments for attempting an eradication because it hasn't been attempted anywhere else. Eradications are difficult, so we have to sometimes accept that it is not feasible. We also need to learn from each of the programs and really try to, you know, for continuous improvement. So we really need to look at this program and have it independently reviewed to look at what went well and what could have been done better. You know, one concern is whether there was too much of a delay before the eradication started, for example. But it needs to be open to review so that we can learn as much as possible from it. And obviously now the critical issues are trying to contain it in Perth so that it doesn't spread further, or the spread is delayed for as long as possible to give us, you know, Australians time to do research into alternative control methods and the potential environmental impacts. And, you know, what we can do in the different environments in which it might have really serious impacts. How the program went, there's just not enough public information to draw any conclusions about the effectiveness. We do know that Australia's government's put a lot of money into it. The Western Australian government put a lot of effort into that program.
Dr. Carol Booth, Policy Director of the Invasive Species Council, ending that story by Sam Giorgio. Forests in New South Wales are being cleared at an alarming rate, with new data revealing a 50% increase in tree loss over the past year. The main cause is large-scale agriculture, and conservationists blame beef producers. They warn that it is destroying wildlife habitats and putting Australia on the map as another global deforestation hotspot. Moamina Shakur talked with Nathaniel Pelle, business and nature lead at the Australian Conservation Foundation.
Most people, if you ask them what is the biggest source of deforestation or land clearing in Australia, will point to the construction of new roads or houses, because that's what we see day to day, you know, at the edges of our cities. Close to me, they're building a new freeway on the Pacific Highway. But it's actually agriculture. Agriculture takes up more than half of the Australian land mass. We've got a pretty big agricultural system. And so just a few farmers bulldozing the bush on their properties adds up to a huge amount. So in New South Wales, in this latest release of data, 77% of it is for agriculture, and it's mainly for beef and sheep production.
I guess, how is this rise impacting Australia's economy in sectors like you mentioned, agriculture?
Look, it's the thing with these nature impacts we're having on nature is sometimes they take a long time to come back to bite us. But for example, we've already seen that because of climate change, the average profitability of a farm has gone down a bit over 20% over the last couple of decades. So farmers are less profitable than they were two decades ago. And normally you want things to go in the other direction.
You know, we talked about New South Wales, but what does this mean for other states when it comes to buying and consuming meat?
Australia is a big producer of sheep and cattle, and we export most of it all over the world. About 70% of what is produced in Australia in terms of beef anyway is exported, possibly even more for sheep. We're the biggest exporter of sheep meat in the world and the third biggest exporter of beef in the world. In Australia, we're mostly buying local beef, and if someone's in Victoria or Tasmania, there's less deforestation happening in Victoria and Tasmania for beef than in some other parts of the country. And the average Victorian, if they're going to a local butcher, is probably getting Victorian cattle. If they're going to Coles and Woolies, it could be coming from anywhere in the country. If they're going to McDonald's or to Hungry Jack's, it could be coming from anywhere in the country, probably from Queensland. And Queensland has the highest rate of deforestation of any state in Australia. It's really New South Wales, Queensland, and unfortunately, increasingly, the Northern Territory where most of it's happening.
What more can the federal government do in order to stop trees being bulldozed for the reason of agriculture?
Solving these problems, ending deforestation and shifting to more sustainable ways of farming, is going to take action from governments as well as from big companies, from banks as well, and farmers themselves. The federal government... It has made a commitment to, as part of its global climate commitment under the Paris Agreement, it's made a commitment to reduce or to halt and reverse, rather, deforestation in Australia.
The Nature Lead at the Australian Conservation Foundation, speaking there with Moamina Shakur.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
If you are looped into a meeting where core values that underpin the purpose statement need some dial-up to ensure key deliverables are on the radar, then it sounds like you will understand what underpins a new book called Wankonomics by James Scofill and Charles Firth. But before we circle back to add value to this discussion, I asked James Scofill where the idea for the book originated.
Usually when you write comedy, you have to make things up. But with this book, it's basically just a verbatim, transcript of conversations and behaviour that takes place in offices. So it was really quite cathartic putting it together, having worked in the corporate world myself for a while. But it really is just a demonstration of what actually goes on in the real world.
Yeah, I remember when I very started my first job, I had to get used to people coming around and going, "Oh, so what did you do on the weekend?" And I go, "I don't know. What did I do on the weekend?" And then I noticed you've got part of the Wankonomics book where Wednesdays are a real problem. Tell us about Wednesdays, Charles.
Well, as you say, like on Mondays and Tuesdays, it's pretty easy to make small talk in the office because the key with small talk is what you want to do is you want to sound friendly, but you don't want to be friends with them. Like you don't want to get so deep in that suddenly you become friends because they're your work colleagues. You hate them, right? So, saying, "Oh, what did you get up to on the weekend?" is a great thing that you can talk about on Mondays and Tuesdays. And then on Thursdays and Fridays, of course, you can say, "Oh, well, what are you getting up to on the weekend?" But that leaves Wednesday as a real problem. I mean, it's essentially a national crisis about what you talk on Wednesdays. I think that's why people have recently invented the term hump day.
Comes up a lot. Just go, "Oh, it's hump day." And you go, "Oh, yeah. Yes."
Something to talk
not
about.
Not far to go to the weekend, only two more days,
Terrible. And so I kind of feel like the answer to this is just making Wednesdays just public holidays, like every single Wednesday.
Oh, that's a very, very good idea. I think that would go down well with a lot of people, yeah. Some of the other things that have come up with modern life is the way people have changed the language and so forth. And you've got a lot of phrases that people talk about, drill down and key competency. Key is another thing that's come up over the years, hasn't it? Where did you collect all these lovely little terms from?
I mean, one of the things about a phrase like drill down, it's a great example of when you use a term to give the impression that what you're doing is a little bit more hands-on and practical than it actually is. Because the truth is a lot of people are just stuck in office jobs, rapidly approaching middle age, sending around PowerPoints and updating Excel spreadsheets. Using a term like drill down, you can imagine that maybe you're on an oil rig out in the Atlantic Ocean drilling for oil. And that gives you a sense that, maybe what you're doing is somewhat useful when really you're just sending around a deck.
Yes, and I think just looking at the definitions you've got here in quickfire definitions, the Wankonomics meaning is to examine in further detail but using a power tool metaphor. to make your work sound more grounded in the real world than it actually is. So they're the sorts of things that, you know, people can actually make sense then of what's going on in some of these meetings.
But sometimes it's confusing, right? Like sometimes actually these metaphors, you end up going, what do you mean drill down? Like what does that actually mean? I mean, and the other one that I've heard recently is double click, right?
Oh, really? What tells you about double click?
Well, it just means drill down.
Oh, okay.
It's the same thing. It just means explore further. Like you double click on something, you sort of drill down on it. But this is a recent phenomenon, the double click one, and it's spreading like a virus throughout sort of the whole workplaces across the world, basically. But I had to be explained what it meant because it was like, well, and it sounds like an old, like it sounds like you should know what it means. But that's but you're just going, it's confusing. I think that's the whole point of all this workplace jargon, right? Like what you don't want is to just say very plainly and simply what you're doing, because you'd probably be able to end your entire workday by about 9:30 in the morning if you just spoke clearly.
Charles Firth there with the way to end the workday early in his book with James Scloffel entitled Wankonomics from Hardy Grant, speaking with me there. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.